Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.
Hello and welcome. Come on in. Sit down with us here on the Pitch Talks podcast for another week. Boy, a great example, if you're a Blue Jays fan, of cooler heads prevailing this week. 2 weeks ago, I mean, we were rock bottom trying to dig our way out, losing games to the Orioles, skidding against Cleveland. Now, it's amazing what one big win against the New York Yankees can do for you. The Jays are off a series win, and now picking up against the Red Sox. The AL East battles rise up, as does, I would say, the emotional strength of our Blue Jays fan nation. Nick, how are you feeling after a couple weeks away and after some wins in the bank for the Blue Jays?
Yeah, I just don't think baseball is well suited to the human condition. The way our brains work and the way the sport works, I just think that there's a discrepancy there. Like, it demands patience, and we don't often have patience, and I'm not saying I'm not guilty of that as well.
Sure.
The reality is this is a quality team. It's going to produce good stretches. Now, there's something to be said about the Yankees being pretty rough right now.
For sure.
That team has been below 500 for a couple months. I'm not saying they're that quality team. That's a good team as well. But that win against the Orioles really stands out to me. That George Springer pinch hit, a guy who's literally never done that in his career because he's always starting.
Not lately.
He's always starting when available. That seemed to get them going. The offense exploded a little bit. Like, this team does live and die with its offense because the pitching isn't perfect. The back of the rotation can be a bit iffy at times. The bullpen has had its ups and downs. What makes this team great when it is great is the offense. And when, I don't know, to use the cliches, they stop gripping the bat so tight or they just get a couple of those big hits, it seems like it can gush from there, and that's what we're seeing right now.
August is a funny month for baseball because you come into August and you're at game 100 and you feel like, man, we've been doing this day in, day out for months. And then you get to the end of August and, oh, there's 40 games left. And now, like, every one of these games suddenly feels like appointment viewing. It is really interesting. And I think you mentioned the Yankees slumping. I think that timing with the Blue Jays coming out of their slump is actually really important for, as you said, the human condition, for remembering, like, every team, even the Yankees, who have so long this year looked like the class of the American League, they're going to have a month where they struggle. The Red Sox went like 21-5 in one of these months, and they've been terrible every month.
The Orioles aren't good.
The Orioles were in a playoff spot for a minute there. Like, it's a good reminder, I think, that it is a long season that can get short quickly. Very interesting. Obviously, I prefer to see the Blue Jays fans with a deep breath in their lungs versus like absolute meltdown mode, fire the GM, everything is broken because they lost to Baltimore. As we said, not your older brother's Baltimore Orioles anymore, but they survive still 10 more against Baltimore. If you are a believer that they are come down to earth, they're coming up on the schedule. So yeah, a really important sort of run there, I think, and now on to Boston and the Angels.
And there, you know, if you take that schedule further, you're going to see the Pirates at the beginning of September.
Yeah.
After that Yankee series, you had 12 games against teams below 500. I know the Red Sox are just there, you know, but they're still, especially now, a team that's not playing their best baseball. So this is the moment right now where they can make up. I don't know if they're going to make up ground on the Yankees sufficient. You know, they're 8 games back as we record. That's a lot. The Yankees would really have to collapse as well as them doing really well. But this is a very crucial moment in the season. And I think there's a good chance that we look back on whether it's that moment with the Baltimore series where they salvaged that one game, getting swept at home against the Orioles would have been really tough.
Yeah.
Whether it's the 3-4 in New York, there's a good chance that we kind of rewind and see that as the turning point for the season. Like, this is the moment where they kind of figured things out, things snapped into gear, and they produced that great finishing stretch. Now, I don't know, they did in 2021. That stretch is going to be really hard to replicate. Like, that was very good. That was about as good as it gets. I don't know if they'll do that, but if they do something in that vicinity, this will be the moment we look back on.
Interesting. I'm glad you sort of bring up last year's run and the comparisons to last year and this year, because I think you get to the end, you look at the stats, say, oh, 91 wins, really successful year for the Blue Jays. I think sometimes we forget that, like, a huge chunk of that was September. And at this time last year, similar conversations were happening. It was like, oh, it's a good team, they're just not ready yet. And then all of a sudden, September, Luis Gurriel is inflamed the entire month, and suddenly it's like, oh my goodness, they're ahead of schedule. Maybe it's happening now. Maybe they're going to make it. They come up one win short. Now, you know, they're in a similar position, having similar conversations, but they've built up three or four more wins than where they were last year, plus they have the extra slot. I think it's a good time to take a deep breath. Some of the takeaways from that Yankees series, we did see some fireworks. I think if you were to make a big list of players in the Blue Jays you would not want to mess with, Alek Manoah is 1A or 1B. For me personally, he's top of the guy. A man that big, that young, that strong from Florida. Whatever you say, brother. Yeah, I'm not crossing the Audi sign. It was Gerrit Cole. Famously sort of getting involved in the dust-up. We saw the punching of the roof, the yelling. It was a hit-by-pitch on a two-seamer. Listen, if Alek Manoah doesn't hit a guy in a game,
that's, a surprise.
That's the real question.
I mean, especially early in his career, that was actually a huge problem for him. And it's weird because it comes up so infrequently with pitchers. Like, there's not a lot of pitchers where you're like, on the scouting report, hits guys a lot. Like, it's, but that was him. Like, that was literally him early. And it was less so this year. But I don't think there's any doubt that that was unintentional. We know the type of guy Manoah is. He wants to face Aaron Judge in that big spot.
For sure.
My big takeaway out of that was sort of Gerrit Cole really filling the role of baseball's antagonist. Like, it is very difficult to find someone who likes Gerrit Cole right now. And it's an amazing confluence of factors, right? Like, one, you've got the incredible talent. He's like the first overall.
Totally.
And then he signed the biggest contract ever for a pitcher at the time. Like, there's no underdog component. He's had the talent since day one. He's kind of silver spoon from a baseball perspective. Number two, he played for those Astros teams that we don't like very much.
Astros, Yankees, double dip.
That's a huge thing.
Boy.
Goes to the Yankees, I don't know, shaves the beard, looks like more annoying somehow. I don't know. You can be biased either way on that, to be fair. we're all entitled to our own opinion.
That's true.
I think I was clean shaven our very last show. This is, if you want to know what 2 weeks does to me, this is it. And then he became the face of Sticky Stuff.
Right.
And so that was the biggest story. It's easy to forget that that was such a big deal. Like, right now it doesn't feel that way, but that was the biggest story in baseball. And he was the face of that. And then he had some performance wobbles during that time. So then it's like, it's all this. And he can't do anything without the spider tack. And his performance is still really good. He's still a very, very good pitcher. Even this season, you know, I think he probably would have been favored to win the AL Cy Young coming into this year. But the fact that he's just been slightly worse has just cracked open the window for people to be like, oh, he's not as good with the Yankees, oh, he's washed, oh, he needs the sticky stuff. And it's kind of amazing the sort of figure he's become, and the whining about that pregame ceremony that went six minutes late. He's really stacking it right now in terms of just dislikability.
It's the perfect storm. He's also hit, I think, a point in his career that a lot of it's like great pitchers of you get to a certain age and you become, this will be the test of the censorship of this show, a bit of a red ass on the mound. You saw it happen to Nolan Bumgarner. You saw it happen to Chris Sale, right? You go from like the exciting young draft pick. Look, this guy's stuff is incredible. He's overpowering people. He's unhittable. And you get to like your early mid 30s and you're like, I actually hate this guy. Wait a minute, I actually hate this. Even Verlander got a little bit of it a couple years ago.
He swung back now.
He did swing back with the media swoon of like just shutting up, to be frank with you.
He had some interesting fashion choices too. He had his like post no hitter fedora and stuff and showed that he wasn't that aggressive masculinity, red assery, as you would put it.
Yes. Gonna test their limit. I think red assery is right on the line. I'm gonna stop
saying. There's an ROI on it, so I don't know. I think that that's better somehow.
It's a lot of letters, and only three of them are troublesome. Lots of different stories, obviously, going on with the Blue Jays. We're gonna get into it a little bit more later with our guest this week, Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet. Obviously, you struggle to find somebody who is more in touch with the Blue Jays fan base, who knows the team top to bottom as well as he does. Again, the offense has woken up a little bit. We've seen some improvements in the rotation. Barrios sort of getting his head above water a little bit. Stripling continues to impress. The big one is the demotion of Yusei Kikuchi down to the bullpen. He had mentioned being willing to go to AAA. That could be something that they re-explore here, because the latest Yusei Kikuchi bullpen adventure was some watch through your fingers type stuff, the walks. What is sort of your read on how terrible Yusei Kikuchi has been?
I mean, there's walks and there's walks, right?
In his
last outing, he just wasn't even close to the plate. And so there are times when you're getting squeezed by the umpire, or you throw a good pitch and you kind of tip your hat to the hitter being able to lay off of it. That's not what's going on. Like, in his first outing, you got the sense that maybe moving to the bullpen was something for him. You know, he threw a lot more fastballs. He had the velo boost. He was pretty efficient with his pitches. And then this time around, he just reminded you of everything he did as a starter. And they're going to bury him for the lowest of the low leverage situations. But it feels like even now, you get that big lead, you bring Kikuchi in, and maybe you're getting the other team back into the ball game, which you can ill afford to do. So it's a tough situation. He probably just needs the reset button. Like, if he came back next year and you penciled him in as the fifth starter, I wouldn't even hate that. Like, I think that just giving him a firm reset with the stuff he has and the talent he has, he can be successful, but he probably can't be successful right now.
It's an interesting conundrum because he's not, financially, he's sticking around. It's $12 million a year for the next 2 years after this one. It's a situation they're going to have to address probably internally. It's not something that, you just trade him, not going to happen. And they also don't have, as you mentioned, fifth starter next year, that they're not bursting with AAA pitchers to replace him with.
Not.
So it's an interesting conundrum to see. I think you sort of do have to find that balance between, the window is now, the window is this year, next year, maybe the year after that for this team. This core is assembled to win right now, and he was brought in to be a part of the rotation that wins right now, and obviously it's not going to be in the playoff rotation. It's probably not going to be in the playoff bullpen. If he appears in a playoff game, something's gone horribly wrong. Yeah. I think there's position players you're putting on the mound before you're putting Kikuchi in right now, but it's not a problem that's going away. It's not, if it's going to be a thing next year, it'll be a thing maybe 2024 as well. So definitely something to monitor. And also, people aren't always brimming with sympathy for somebody making $12 million a year to not perform all that well at their job. I do, though, hold a little space of, I do feel for him a little bit because, as you said, there's walks. And the last outing was very much as soon as it happened, sort of every fan is like, oh, here we go. Can't even use him in this. And I think that's such a tough situation for a guy to be in mentally. Very hard. As you said, you need the reset button. Maybe he does need to get under AAA just to get out of the spotlight a little bit and pitch in the dark a little bit of just sort of getting my stuff together, getting myself right, getting back to basics, getting simple. I do hope there is some salvage there because it is tough to watch, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's happening with Julian Merriweather right now. Like, his stuff really didn't play for a lot of this year, even though he had the big velocity like Kikuchi, and he's working in AAA and working pretty effectively. One thing that's been encouraging sort of on the human element side of it is that it does seem like he has his teammates behind him. I saw the other day there was a quote from Matt Chapman where he had just heard that Kikuchi offered to go down to AAA, which he didn't know. And he literally said, oh, I'm going to go and hype him up right now.
I love Matt Chapman.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Chapman's great. And, the fact that it'd be easy for his teammates to say, look, we're trying to win right now. When he's on the mound, we have a horrible record. He's impeding this playoff race that we're in. And there probably are a couple guys, to be honest, in that clubhouse who are feeling that way. But the fact that it seems like a lot of the team is behind him is, it's really encouraging about where this clubhouse is at, which is something that you're never able to put your finger firmly on the pulse, even if you're there every day, even if you're a beat reporter. It's hard to know exactly what the feel is. But that's a good sign for me.
Speaking of fingers on the pulse, speaking of good feelings.
Oh, boy.
Speaking of my domain, anybody can open up StatCast and tell you the exit velocities, I assume. there has been a development in Blue Jays internet. The culture wars have added a new soldier. Listen, in general, in a blanket statement, joining Twitter in 2022 is a questionable decision to make. However, if you're going to do it, you do it like John Gibbons, former manager of the Blue Jays, has done, exploding onto the scene over the weekend, giving us that Gibby flavor. My initial instinct, my first instinct was one of skepticism, of are we getting a marketing account here where it's a 25-year-old intern in a different city authoring the tweets, but
no, that's not what we're getting.
Pretty quickly, the Gibbyism of it all has revealed itself. I'm having a blast with it. Obviously, one foot in, one foot out, sort of, it could unravel at any time. That's the nature of Twitter. But first impressions for me is two rousing thumbs up on the interaction with Gibby, the willingness to engage with this fan base, which can be difficult, questionable at times, people to interact with. It seems like he's having a blast. People are having a blast talking to him. Nick, I know the social media world for me and for you can be a little bit of a different flavor. How are you enjoying the early days of the John Gibbons online experience?
I think it's great. I think it's exactly what people wanted. Like, Blue Jays fans love Gibby. They love Gibby the first time. They loved him the second time. They associate him with the great 2015 team. They associate him often if their fandom is a little bit earlier. Like, because he had these two stints, he captures two different generations of Blue Jays fans. And he also was sort of the polar opposite of what people didn't like about Charlie Montoyo. Like, they didn't feel like he had the same level of character, that he wasn't as likable, that he was a bit mechanical in his answers or wasn't providing all the information. Like, people liked about Gibby is that he said everything that was on his mind. Mm-hmm. Now, I've sat in his office many a time and listened to him during pregames. Sometimes everything that's on his mind is more than you necessarily need to hear, but the media does a good job of filtering that and creating the right funnel for the fan base there. He's a character. And like you said, he's not doing a stilted, here's a branding opportunity. And he has mentioned that there's going to be a podcast, but he's not using this strictly to funnel you to something that's going to make him money. He's genuinely engaging with a fan base that absolutely loves him, and he loves him back. There's probably a little bit of pandering going on there. I don't know how much he actually misses Tim Hortons. I'm sorry. but there, you know, Toronto's the greatest city, etc. I miss it every day. But no, it's great. It's what people miss, honestly. Like, on social media, I think a lot of time people are frustrated because they have these figures that they care about, and that's what they desperately want to do is engage with them, and instead they get this sort of branded stonewalling.
Right.
And we don't need to go like into the broad scope of what's good and bad on social media, but he's kind of the opposite of that. He is as genuine and unfiltered as it gets. He makes horrible spelling mistakes. He jokes about them later. Like you said, I'll give it the two thumbs up as well. I think it's been fantastic.
Zooming out a little bit league-wide before we get on to our guest, a couple, I'd say three things right now running alongside in the zeitgeist of Major League Baseball. We have Albert Pujols' pursuit of 700 home runs. We have the Mariners maybe breaking a lengthy playoff drought. And we have Aaron Judge chasing down the AL and Yankee record of 61 home runs. What of those things is interesting you right now on a day-in, day-out basis?
It's got to be Pujols.
Yeah.
First of all, he's hot. He's doing so well.
In his career average, I saw he has his career average WRC plus this year. It's like, this is literally a career year in the sense of like, this is who he's been the whole time sort of conversation.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. He's someone we, I think, absolutely fairly assumed was completely washed.
Sure.
And maybe he still is, to be honest. I don't know. It's the last juice, the last twitch, whatever it is. It's working for him. They're using him a lot against left-handed pitchers, which is how you're supposed to use him these days. But I find myself really cheering for him to get 700 home runs. I know that that isn't like a record. It's not a big enough club, really, for it to be the 700 club, and some of the members of that you feel differently about than others, depending. So it's a complicated thing, but he's an easy guy to cheer for. I saw a tweet the other day about him just giving his game-used jersey to this fan in the front row behind the dugout who had a sign that said, Albert, let's trade jerseys, and he just did it. Like, you see guys signing balls and stuff before games, but you don't always see that level of interaction. The Judge thing is cool. The thing about Judge is it just depends, like, how do you personally feel about 61 home runs?
Right.
Like, is 61 home runs, because he's not getting 74,
no.
You know?
Yeah, of course.
So it's like, how do I feel about that particular number? And I'm not sure I feel as strongly as some people are that, like, this is the true home. I remember Chris Davis was flirting with that at one point.
Right.
And Stanton even was a little bit. And some people were very invested in that idea. Like, this is the home run record, and this home run chase would be incredible. I don't know if I'm quite that person who's saying, oh, everything that happened during that era didn't happen. And so I find myself a little bit less invested in that.
Yeah, it's more, for me, it's almost more the Yankee record than it is the home run record writ large. On Pujols, I think, bang on with it, somebody that I'm happy that we're getting this, because you would sort of hate for... He was such an important part of the last two decades of baseball, and like, easy to forget because of the Angels run that for the
not a great decade.
Yeah, absolutely right. But for his first run with the Cardinals, it was like an unbelievable generational talent of like consistent production every year. It was like, this dude does not slow down. And we'll get into our next topic. I'll sort of weave it in here. I'm also struck with the, like, man, if he didn't play for the Angels, I feel like he would have 800 home runs. It's just sort of like, playing for the Angels curses you to be like, not have the success that you're supposed to have. I think there's something to that. I'm just like, the Angels are just cursed. All they get is generational talents. The two best players you're going to have in this generation, and Ohtani and Trout, nothing to show for it. Albert Pujols says the only stain on his career is, like, as soon as he leaves or before he gets there, just an amazing generational talent. The time in Anaheim, completely forgettable. I'm rooting for the 700 for sure.
Yeah, and before we get to the Angels, because there is news there, I do think it's worth touching on this Mariners playoff drought.
I know, of course.
Blue Jays fans may not have sympathy because of what happened between 1993 and 2015, but the Mariners have been kind of like the Angels, like such a cursed franchise. So many talents rolled through there. Randy Johnson, Ken Griffey Jr., Edgar Martinez, Ichiro, and they just weren't able to ever capitalize on these amazing players that they had. And right now, it looks like they've got another one in Julio Rodriguez. We don't know the story of his career just yet. I think it's kind of a likable bunch of players. Ty France, sort of a blue-collar star there. Eugenio Suarez, a guy, again, that started off as a utility player, sort of, and made himself into a star. I think that team's a lot of fun to watch. They've got some great young pitching as well. I think the idea of them being in the playoffs is exciting from a broader fan perspective, but I do think we're preaching to the wrong fan base here because Blue Jays fans say, oh, 21 years is nothing.
Yeah, I agree with you. A likable team, a team to root for, and I just think it sort of is nice to see a team that last year maybe overperformed. I think, again, we're speaking to a lot of Jays fans. I think we looked at this and went, oh, 91 wins. Yeah, but they're really talented. So, like, they're going to get the 91 eventually. And it was like, oh, the Mariners' 90 wins is not real. And they were so good in close games. It's not a real run. And even earlier this year, out of the gate, they did not have a strong start to the season. But I was really happy that they spent the offseason saying, okay, we were close. We're going to supplement this team with talent. And then at the deadline, it's like, we're close. We're on a run. We're going to go get Luis Castillo. We're going to bulk up. We're going to address the problems. I think that is something that we went through 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, where teams just weren't doing that. Whether it's the new wild card spot or whether it's just that a lot of, as you said, the young talent's coming home to roost for this team. I really root for teams that say, hey, we're on the bubble. We're going to go up instead of down. I think that's really admirable. They built the farm system. Now they're supplementing the major league talent. I think it's admirable and what teams are supposed to do. You're supposed to want to try to win, whether you think you're going to win the World Series or not. You're supposed to try to want to get to the dance. So I'm into it. I'm pro Mariners. Let's get the M's in there. I think, man, you're talking about a little mini rivalry. If you had Jays Mariners playoffs, it'd be interesting to see how that building shakes out. I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think in Toronto it'd be interesting because you'd have the Robbie Ray vaccination status going on.
Maybe
not the most, exciting one, but intriguing perhaps. And then in Seattle you would have the migrating fan storyline and, how does that building net out? Obviously, I think you probably wouldn't have the same extent, but it would still be a factor. I want to move on to the Angels, though, like you said, because Artie Moreno, the owner of the Angels, looks like he's selling the team. And people have described him as like the most meddling owner in sports, or in MLB at least. And when you combine that with the level of failure associated with the Angels, this has to be considered a positive thing for a franchise that is, one of the more important franchises in baseball, even if it hasn't been in the last couple of years in terms of on-field success, a franchise that could afford to spend more money based on its market, one that has these two unbelievable superstars. I'm excited to see what the Angels are able to do if they have, an ownership that presumably lets the front office do their job a little bit more. But I'm also skeptical because part of what the Angels have done poorly has been getting role players, getting back the rotation started. Like the type of moves that an owner would not meddle in are the ones they continue to fail on.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it's going to be an instant fix, but I do like the idea of the Angels sort of rising to prominence again, hopefully while they still have Trout and Ohtani, although that's not a given, at least on Ohtani's side.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I'm sure a lot of teams would have loved their owner to meddle them into Ohtani.
Yeah.
And at the time, a lot of teams would have meddled their way into signing Rendon.
Yeah.
It's almost a matter of, like, it's not that they aren't spending money, that they're not spending it properly, or that they're not spending it, as you said, they're not allocating it in the right way. They're meddling for these huge things and then missing out on the parts that make a baseball team win. The little things, the role players, the pitching depth, the bullpen, the intelligence, and in general, I think it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. Because again, the one thing that they've done that a lot of teams the level of top end talent is unquestionable. Trout and Ohtani, those two can paper over a lot of your mistakes, but when
not
the
all of them.
Evidently not, and obviously there's there part of it is they played in a division with Houston, who's had an unprecedented run of success, but the Mariners are doing it, and they're doing it without Ohtani and Trout. They're doing it by investing in their farm, getting those young talent, and then supplementing them with the stars. The failure of not developing anybody,
anyone?
Correct me if
yeah,
I'm wrong.
Anyone.
Has anybody been developed in the Trout era? Joe Adell was sort of rumored to be that guy, but it, you know, they got
Ward has been pretty good this year, but mainly a hot start. Like, people thought Jared Walsh was a left-handed power hitter for a bit.
Yeah.
Angels not great. They are coming to town to face the Blue Jays the weekend after this recording, and we have Blue Jays beat reporter and MLB editor for Sportsnet Ben Nicholson-Smith joining the show now.
We are thrilled to be joined now by our guest for this week. We'll talk about one of the good guys in media.
Absolutely.
In a space that can be competitive, that can be difficult at times. One of the true gems of the industry, a friend of ours, somebody we are thrilled to have join us, Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet and At the Letters Podcast. Thank you, Ben, for joining us.
Yeah, Zeus, it's great to be with you guys, Nick. Happy to talk baseball as always. I think, I was saying before, I just root for media. I like to see great conversations take place, great content out there. So always happy to catch up with you guys and talk Jays and see what you're up to on this new endeavor.
Oh, thank you, Ben. That's so classic Ben Nicholson-Smith kindness exuding out of every pore. Obviously, fully entrenched in the Blue Jays, you know, that beat, that market, the fans constantly tweeting at you. And you know, we hit rock bottom 2 weeks ago, a nice sort of example of cooler heads prevailing, fresh off a series against the Yankees. Sort of how have you seen a change in the tenor around the team? How did that Yankees series sort of change things, both I think internally, externally as well, from both the way the team is performing and feeling and the way the fans are feeling about the team?
Yeah, I guess I think there was a big shift because they really missed opportunities preceding that series against the Guardians, against the Orioles. They just missed chances. And so to go into that series against the Yankees, things could have gone wrong. Like, they definitely could have gone in the other direction, and they were fighting for their lives to just make sure that they were staying ahead of the Orioles a matter of days before that Yankee series. But then they went in there and they just played great, and they clearly outplayed the Yankees. And honestly, my biggest takeaway coming away from that series didn't even have that much to do with the Blue Jays. It had more to do with the Yankees and their fans and just how intense that fan base is. Like, from afar, of course, you think Yankees and Dodgers. These are the best two teams in baseball. I mean, throw in the Mets or Atlanta, throw in the Astros. But really, the Yankees are the class of the American League this year. And yet their fans were just on them, booing Aroldis Chapman and Aaron Hicks and Aaron Boone, and just really interesting vibes there at Yankee Stadium. And the Jays, by playing well, really compounded that and made it more intense. So I think things are getting interesting. The Jays have put themselves back in a good spot to at least finish in a really good wild card position. Probably not the American League East, but still they've advanced things and pushed things along by playing really well.
At the risk of using a catchphrase, you love to see it.
I was going to say, I think our listeners, largely Blue Jays fans, are always happy to hear about the downfall of the Yankees. This team is, you know, well below 500, maybe not well below, but a little below 500 since kind of mid-June. And I'm wondering what your impression of that team was. You mentioned sort of the fan base and the atmosphere, but just the quality of that team. Are you starting to question, yeah, that initial prior that they are the class of the American League and, you know, running away with the AL East? Did you come away from that series thinking that maybe the Yankees weren't the team you thought they were?
I do think that compared to where the Yankees were a month ago, a couple important things have changed. Trading away Jordan Montgomery, who's been amazing with the St. Louis Cardinals, I thought that was a mistake at the time. Now it definitely looks to be one. And then the bullpen, too. They've had some injuries and just underperformances from Aroldis Chapman and others. So the bullpen, which for such a long time looked to be a huge strength of that team, now looks weakened. And so does the rotation, in my opinion, with Montgomery gone. So it's still a great offensive team. I think that, you know, once Stanton is back, Rizzo gets into a bit more of a rhythm, there's still going to be a force offensively. And they're one of two teams, along with the Dodgers, to have scored more runs, or not score more runs, but to have a better WRC plus than the Blue Jays this year. I see that continuing. So overall, this is a really strong team. Are they the best team in the American League? I mean, right now, I might actually say the Astros are, but the Yankees are still a force.
Lots being made in the last couple of weeks. Obviously, the additions the Blue Jays made or didn't make, and the question marks that we'd seen surrounding obviously got a lot louder, as you mentioned, around that Baltimore series. One of the key ones, though, is the performance of Jose Berríos. We have seen, I mean, listen, your ERA is the highest in the league. People are going to notice that and talk about you, but quietly, the last nine starts, six of them quality starts, obviously not the most hard and fast stat in the world. But what have you seen in terms of improvement? What's your level of confidence? Sort of talk us up positively about Jose Berríos. I do this every week. Somebody convince me that Jose Berríos is going to be fine, please.
I hope your next week's guest is more persuasive than I will be on that one, because I don't know, Zoobs. Like, I'm just not sure I can do that. I'm not sure that I can persuade you that Jose Berríos is fixed or is someone that you can have full confidence in. He's allowed more home runs than anyone in the American League. As you said, the highest ERA in baseball. And it's just the fastball is getting crushed, just absolutely destroyed, and has been all year. So until he can consistently show improved fastball command for, I want to say, four or five starts, I'm just not quite there. I think when we zoom out at the big picture, it's clear the results haven't been there this season. He needs to be better with fastball location, and we haven't seen that often enough. So I still think, you know, when you look at the way the playoffs are going to unfold, you need four starters, and he's one of those starters. I mean, clearly ahead of Mitch White or, you know, Yusei Kikuchi, you know, those guys are much further down the depth chart than Berríos. And so you're going to need them, whether it's a game 163, whether it's in the wild card series, whether it's game one of the division series, and then potentially game five to get where they want to go. The Jays need Berríos, but I'm just not convinced that they can have a ton of confidence in him when he is taking the mound. And so on those days, you probably have to be prepared to go to your bullpen very early if it appears that he doesn't have his good stuff.
One piece we saw over at Sportsnet.ca, a little plug for an incredibly well-known brand that doesn't need it, was Shai. He had a piece on how the bench has really improved for the Blue Jays recently. And I think that was maybe an underrated issue all year long. You had a lot of, you know, Zach Collins sitting around for months at a time, not doing anything. You had a lot of, you know, Bradley Zimmer appearing in every game but never taking an at-bat. We had to learn who Vinny Capra was at one point this season. It seems like things have settled down a little bit in that fast of the game. What are you seeing with the position player depth and how it could help the Blue Jays down the stretch?
Well, it's incredibly important, too, because at this point, George Springer is more of a DH, so you probably need some depth in center field to really help you out there, whether that's Jackie Bradley Jr., whether it's Whit Merrifield. Neither one of those guys is actually hit, but at least they give you some defensive ability at some up the middle positions. I think, you know, the bench, if we include Raimel Tapia in that, which I think is probably fair to say, Kevin Biggio, and then some days you have Danny Jansen on the bench, you have some good major league players on the bench. And that's a really good place to be as a major league team. Now, I still think the core of this team is the 1-8. And I was looking at it this morning. They have 8 players on a regular basis in their lineup who are league average or above by OPS plus, including obviously some players who are well above that, and Kirk and Vladdy and Springer. So it's just that consistency that you get from your main group of players, and then complemented with, yeah, you have a Jackie Bradley Jr. He has a clear role on a major league team. Merrifield gives you something. Of course, the catching tandem has been really good all season long. And then Biggio is a nice complementary piece as well. So yeah, as I look at this group, you know, I still think there was a strong case to be made for finding a way to keep Bradley Zimmer on the roster somehow. Weren't able to do that, but it's still a good group when you look at the bench, and potentially some more upside there, because I do think offensively there's more from Merrifield than what he's showing so far.
As we approach September and October, obviously we're going from sort of regular season questions to postseason questions. And one of the big postseason questions, and we see this, the way the game is changing, is bullpen usage. I know it was sort of the number one thing that radio callers or commenters or Twitter people would complain about, is the Jays didn't make the big bullpen splash. But since the deadline, the bullpen ERA is under 3. Anthony Bass especially has been impressive. ERA of 1. Not one run in 9 innings, if I'm not mistaken on that one. What have sort of your impressions been of the bullpen? Is there somebody, you know, Pearson, Merriweather, Zulueta, Pop, even, that you can see maybe adding that, you know, one extra arm that makes a difference? Or so, what are your thoughts on what the bullpen is versus maybe the perception of where they were a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, I think it's improved for sure. And I was with anyone who is kind of questioning whether the Jays did enough. I mean, I was certainly in that group. And I think, even with the benefit of, I guess, a few weeks hindsight at this point, I still think they came short of what they could have and should have done at the deadline when it comes to adding pitching. Right now, I mean, to have Mitch White as your five and really no one as your six, you know, that's sort of thin in the rotation. And in the bullpen, I just think there's room for one more. Despite the fact that they performed really well over that stretch, they're vulnerable to one injury. Now, the trio of Jordan Romano and Jimmy Garcia and then Anthony Bass, that looks really good, especially if you get Jimmy Garcia some rest. His stuff looks sharper when he's got a couple of days rest. So that's really important for this team. And Bass, like you said, with the slider, he looks really good. That's a great pickup. Of course, you could use more, though. I think that they're now in a position where if there was one injury to one of those pitchers, then you start to get a little thin. You start to put Adam Simber in situations where maybe you don't want to, or you start praying that, I mean, as good of a prospect as Yosfer Zulueta is, we're still talking about someone who's recently coming off an injury, 19, 20 years old, never pitched above the high minors. So that's a massive ask, and we'll see if the Jays make it. It could be intriguing as a possibility. But I think of those three that you mentioned, Pearson, not really someone I would look to expect a lot from. Merriweather, I think we see at some point, and we'll see if he can command the stuff that we know is really good. And, you know, we'll see about guys like Hayden Younger or Zulueta, who are probably a bit further away, in my opinion.
One more name you can throw into that mix, very noticeable, was not mentioned in either the rotation talk or the bullpen talk. It's Yusei Kikuchi. Mm. Obviously, the answer to the question could be as simple as just no, but do you think that there is anything to his ability to pitch in relief? In that first outing, he did look interesting in a more civilized role. Yeah, and then the second one was a problem, but obviously not a guy for high leverage. But what do you see with the early experimentation then?
It's interesting because, you know, this is
the word for
word of the day.
and I mean, we're talking about someone who, and I mean interesting because this is a $12 million dilemma for each of the next 2 years. I don't mean interesting because I think that there's much of a chance that he offers the Blue Jays much. But I think it is going to be very fascinating to see how this unfolds. Now, for me, you look at a pitcher who has consistently lacked command for a period of months now. And I mean, his command is just well below average. I've said it before. If he was a high school draft prospect, you would say his command is way below average. Put that in the major leagues, his command is way below average. It's just not playable. So to me, I would need to see probably 15 or 20 innings of Kikuchi commanding the ball before I would suggest that it's a good idea for the Toronto Blue Jays to put him in a situation with leverage.
It's a long season. Everybody slumps. Boston got hot. The Yankees are slumping. The Blue Jays have had their hot and cold streaks. But we are at autumn is on the doorstep here. September is arriving. What is your sort of overall summation of where they've been versus where you expected, and a bit of an outlook for September? We know last year, very hot September got them right to the doorstep. What do you see in terms of how they're positioned coming up here with this next, 40 games to go before we get into the playoff zone?
Yeah, great question. I think that, you know, to me, this is a team that's underperformed expectations. They're on an 89-win pace as we record this. Clearly, they have the potential to do better than that. So they need to finish stronger than what they've shown so far. And given what we know about this team, its health, its potential, and the schedule ahead of them, I really do think that it's a reasonable expectation that they can push that pace ahead and finish with, 92 wins. Something in that range seems doable to me. 91, 92, right around where they were last year. And that should be in the range of wins to get them that first wild card seed that they need. So that's really important to me. That'll determine how hard they have to push down the stretch with players like Manoa, who, you know, ideally you probably wouldn't mind giving him a little breather here and there, an extra day between starts. But if they're still pushing for that final playoff spot, I think it's important to get the most out of Romano, Springer, Jimmy Garcia, those guys that you might otherwise rest a little bit, because you want to establish that top seed going into the first round. Winning the first round, I think, is a must for this team. I think if they're bounced out in a three-game series, that's a disappointing outcome for a team that began the year with World Series aspirations. But honestly, as we watch them play right now, in the last week or so, I think it's easy to be reminded of the potential that they do have. And I could see this team making the World Series. I'm not predicting it. I'm not saying that it's likely. I know you guys have a great read on the numbers as well. And you know, the probabilities, of course, are that the Jays will be bounced at some point. But I think they could play in the World Series with this roster and be pretty interesting. But a lot of things would have to go right, and it starts with a stronger finish than what they've shown so far.
Before you get out of here, we know that you're an expert on the Blue Jays, but also just a fan of MLB in general and baseball. And the Blue Jays seem to have MLB arriving on their doorstep in the form of the Los Angeles Angels. Obviously not a relevant team to the playoff picture, but you've got Shohei Ohtani coming in to do his two-way thing in Toronto for the first time. So one, I wanted to get your thoughts on sort of the significance of that, because we don't know how long that's going to last. Like, there's a world where he gets traded to another team and maybe it's in the NL, or he has injuries and this only goes so long. So it could be, I mean, I don't want to be a doom and gloom guy who says it's going to be the only time, but conceivably it could be. And then the second side of that is that Artie Moreno looks like he might be selling the team, which could factor into Ohtani's future. And, you know, major player in the baseball landscape leaving and changing the fortunes potentially of one of the biggest franchises.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, with just 2 years remaining before, or is it 1 year before he's
a free agent?
I think it's 1 year before he's a free agent. So they really have to capitalize on this window or see him walk. And reading between the lines with his comments, it sounds like he is someone who wants to win and would potentially be prepared to walk away in free agency from the Angels for a better opportunity. So, you know, I think by 2024, he's playing for someone else. And the Jays had interest at the time that he was coming over from Japan, made a strong push, didn't end up landing him, of course. But even to see him as a visitor, to answer the first part of your question, Nick, I mean, I'm excited to be there on Saturday and watch him. I think the talent that he has, I've talked to people who have watched a lot of baseball who say that Shohei Ohtani is the best athlete they've ever seen on a baseball field. And it's hard to debate that when you look at the speed and the power and what he can do on the mound, even adding a two-seamer now as a pitcher. It's been incredible to watch. So for me, as a fan of the game, super excited to see Shohei Ohtani. And then, like you say, there's a ton of intrigue there moving forward. And whatever team he lands on, it is just going to get an incredible player. I mean, I'm sure the kind of talent that, you know, the Dodgers will be trying to get, and the Giants and the Yankees and the Red Sox. And of course, the Jays need to be in that mix as well whenever it is that Shohei Ohtani becomes available, because he's, I mean, we've seen it the last couple of years. He's really as good as it gets in two ways. It's best case scenario for what he could have become. And so it should be a lot of fun to see where that one goes.
Yeah, no kidding. That's going to be that's appointment viewing on Saturday. I think it's Ohtani Manoah. That's what also about as good as you can possibly get in terms of a reason to be tuned in and down at the Domey. Well, no, you will be there, Ben. Of course, you are always on the scene, entrenched in the Blue Jays beat. We appreciate your time. We know you're a busy guy. We will let you get back. Ben Nicholson-Smith from Sportsnet and the At the Letters podcast. Thank you so much for joining us here on Pitch Talks.
You got it, Zubes. Thank you to you and Nick, and we'll talk soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Ben.
And now, brought to you by North Star Bets. Nick, North Star Bets author, myself, The Parlay, working here with North Star Bets. It is time to check out some of our favorite odds of the week on the run line. All right, Nick, what do you have you're looking at? You know me, I like a big number with a comma in it and a plus sign at the front. There's a lot of races. Again, we are approaching September. Your award races are starting to sort of, you know, the separating the wheat from the chaff. We are getting the real contenders and maybe one candidate in each spot. We talked about the Cy Youngs the last couple of times. What do you have your eye on right now?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any commas for you, unfortunately. No, you're getting to the point where you have one or two real candidates and then maybe a couple dark horses. But one race that I find fascinating is the NL Rookie of the Year. I know this might not be familiar to some Blue Jays fans, but you have a rare situation where you have two guys at negative odds right now. You have Spencer Strider minus 137 as we record, Michael Harris minus 110. That could move a little bit, but essentially it's a 1-2 and everyone else is so far in the distance, and they're teammates. And you rarely see guys come up with the same team the same year, a wave of young talent of that quality. And they're two very different guys. Strider is, you know, he's a fireballer. He throws 98. They started him in the bullpen, and then he came to the rotation. You assume, oh, his effectiveness will fall off a little bit. His stuff will fall off a little bit. Didn't happen. He's just one of the elite swing and miss guys in the National League from day one as a starter. That's pretty incredible. And then Michael Harris II, he's that all-around player. He runs. He plays incredible defense in the outfield. He hits the ball very hard. If I have to go for one, I would probably put my money behind Strider because some of Harris's underlyings, like he doesn't necessarily hit the ball hard as consistently, like his expected stats are lagging a little bit. He doesn't walk much and he strikes out a lot. I think long term, over the course of his career, you still feel good about him. But over the short term, he feels like someone who could maybe take a couple steps back. Like we're catching him perhaps at his hottest point right now.
The teammates thing is very interesting to sort of see a team with two rookies in that conversation. I do like the difference of a pitcher and a hitter in a sort of a nice little conversation as to what you consider value, what you consider to be something that, as you said, down the stretch, which of those things in the last month is going to be the thing that helps them stand out, whether it be, you know, you mentioned the switch to the rotation from the bullpen from Strider, if you see that maybe eventually catching up to him, or if you see that being a thing that pushes him ahead. You can sort of take it either way. The double minus money is negative money, negative odds, if you will, is very intriguing to me and something fun to watch, especially if you're a fan of the team.
Yeah, I mean, you can debate which one you want to pick all you want. What's not up for debate is the Braves have a really bright future ahead of them. And when you bring on these two quality players to a team that has, you know, Acuna Jr. not having his best season, but still a building block for them. Albies injured right now, still a building block. You know, Austin Riley, one of the best power hitters in the majors. The Braves have a really exciting young core. It's very clear that one of these guys will take home the award, and I think both of them are going to be huge parts of their future. In terms of if I had one to pick for their future, give me the position player. Less likely his shoulder is going to fall off.
Right.
He's got the rounded skill set. He plays every day. But this particular year from Spencer Strider is something special.
Speaking of National League races and speaking of teammates being 1-2, something I've been very interested in is the National League MVP race. In the AL, with a little sewn up, it's going to be Aaron Judge, more or less. The National League also has a pretty big favorite. Paul Goldschmidt currently is minus 500. The interesting thing to me here, though, is Nolan Arenado across the diamond. You have first and you have third. He is really shooting up the ranks. He was pretty far down. Now he is your second place. It's plus 1,300. It obviously is a stretch. And, you know, them both being on the Cardinals, them both being in the same infield, them both being in the same lineup is going to make it hard for there to be a huge separation. Goldschmidt is your moneymaker, is your guy who brings home the bacon and fries it in the pan. However, it's a bit of a new school, old school argument because Arenado, in addition to being a dangerous hitter, is a superlative defensive player. 99th percentile in everything you want to look at. You go to the Statcast, it's red circles everywhere. He's really, really captivating to watch defensively. He does things nobody else can do. It's sort of, you know, coming into the year, it was sort of him and Matt Chapman and then everybody else. And I think he's even then, as great as Chapman has been, the plays he's made, the work he's done, especially recently, to sort of undo some of that regression. Arenado has not hindered at all. He's unbelievable defensively. He makes a lot of incredible plays. He makes a difference on both sides. And if you look at it, if you want to go the new school, the war, Fangraphs war, they're basically tied. It's obviously, you treat war like a starting point, not an ending point, but there's a lot to like with Arenado. If you're minus 500 is a little bit too much, no value for you, and the Cardinals continue to sort of make their moves and win hearts and minds with the Pujols story, there's a lot to like for me with Nolan Arenado.
Yeah, I mean, I could make you an argument that Arenado is a better, more effective player in 2022. And so the fact that these odds are so disparate is interesting. And we talked before on this show about the difference between on-field value and potential MVP voting or whatever the award may be. And, you know, we talked about Verlander before, how he has that boost of being that favorite and the Hall of Fame legacy and being so old and the comeback story. Similarly, I think people like the Goldschmidt side because it's simpler. Like, he has been the best hitter in the National League, and it's unquestioned. Like, it's by a decent margin here, whereas Arenado's case is more complicated. It's like, how do I weigh the defensive value? There's multiple defensive metrics out there. Which one do I prefer? Do I want to aggregate all of them? How much value do I place on his ability to play a more premium defensive position so that someone else in his lineup can play a different position? Like, Goldschmidt taking up first base means that another guy can't play first base, and there's value in that. And we quantify all these things in war, and that's the reason why they end up being tied. But then you go look at, you know, a box score, and you just see Goldschmidt OBP well over 400, home runs over 30, triple digit RBI, all that stuff that says, okay, this is the guy for this team that's making the team win. And that's probably going to be more compelling to voters. But if Goldschmidt were to slump down the stretch and Arenado were to stay hot, maybe the advanced stats gap starts to go like this and you start to wake a few people more up that Arenado's been maybe essentially as good. So I don't hate a couple bucks on Arenado right now, even though, yeah, my gut is telling me that at the end of the day, it'll be Goldschmidt.
Let me creep in. Goldschmidt taking at bats away from Pujols, question mark?
Yeah. He's stopping the road.
I mean, what's a better story than Albert Pujols? No, absolutely. I think you said it great. It's a ton of fun to build a five-minute argument for Arenado. Just so happens that the Goldschmidt argument is like, yeah, but he's the best.
Yeah, he's the one people will vote for.
And
that's what it is.
And the story of sort of, being so good in Arizona for so long and then sort of getting a bigger spotlight. Obviously, St. Louis is a hotbed for baseball, very much a perennial National League team to talk about if you're following the National League. Always in the mix, always competitive, always either in the playoffs or knocking on the door, and notorious for winning 87 games and then winning the World Series somehow. It's a bigger platform, and he's really made the most of it. You see people sometimes shrink, or in the part of his career he is in, sort of start to tail off. He's only gotten better. He's only gotten stronger. A deserving MVP candidate as well. But you got to love the defensive highlights. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, Arenado is more fun to watch. Unfortunately, Ward is not who is the most fun to watch player in the league.
He's the guy doing the splits on the other end of the throws sometimes.
Yeah, and Goldschmidt's, he's got the great numbers for a first baseman, but he's also not... the Stanton, the Judge, I guess the O'Neill Cruz now, if you guys saw that he hit the hardest hit ball of the stack this year. Like, he is obviously really good at all those things, but like, picture in your head Paul Goldschmidt home run. Nothing specific comes to mind.
Yeah.
And that's not to say he doesn't hit big home runs from time to time or whatever. He just doesn't have the stylistic flair. That being said, again, that is not what's on the ballot. So yes, he will probably win MVP.
If you're looking at place, your bet, and make your call on Rookie of the Year or MVP or any of the futures or any action at MLB's daily slate of games. Check out NorthstarBets.ca. You get Nick's work, all kinds of great insights from some great authors over there. NorthstarBets.ca. That about does it for another episode of Pitch Talks. We are so close to September and October baseball. The air is getting colder. The days are getting shorter. The baseball is getting better and better. I am so excited to be down the stretch with you, Nick, with you, our audience on YouTube and on podcast platforms. Please give us a rating, give us a thumbs up, give us 5 stars, leave us a comment. It really helps us algorithmically get to the top of those charts and top of those little boards that mean so much to the people in power. And it means so much to us. It's a great way to support the show. We thank you so much for tuning in to Pitch Talks.
Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.